This podcast is brought to you by WRFL, Radio Free Lexington. Find us online at WRFL.fm. Catch us on your FM radio while you're in Central Kentucky at 88.1 FM, all the way to the left. Thank you for listening, and please be sure to subscribe.
Welcome to Campus Voices, where each week we take a look at key issues that affect students, the UK campus, and in the Lexington community. I'm your host, Penny Schmitz, and today we're talking about the latest developments in the heroin epidemic going on not only in Lexington, but also throughout the entire state of Kentucky. WRFL reporter Michael Ayers gets us started.
Finding pure heroin just isn't the case anymore. Dealers are finding ways to mix heroin with other drugs that are 50 to 100 times more potent. Fentanyl is a Schedule II prescription opioid for severe pain. Other names for this drug consist of Atic, Durazic, and Sublimaze. Deputy Director in the White House's Office of National Drug Control Policy, Mary Lou Leary, told NPR, "Heroin is bad enough, but when you lace it with fentanyl, it's like dropping a nuclear bomb on the situation." To make matters worse, fentanyl isn't the worst drug heroin is being mixed with. Carfentanil is starting to make its way into central Kentucky. Carfentanil is a synthetic opioid painkiller, which is 10,000 times more potent than morphine. According to the DEA, carfentanil is used as a tranquilizing agent for elephants and other large mammals. Carfentanil is 100 times more potent than fentanyl and can resemble powdered cocaine and heroin. Not only does this put intravenous drug users at huge risk, but also authorities. Simply breathing in a dose of carfentanil can be fatal. Heroin statistics are only getting worse in Fayette County, but major changes in resources are being implemented into the city so addicts can find help. According to the Lexington-Fayette Urban County Council Substance Abuse and Violence Intervention Program, in 2013 there were 81 overdoses, in 2014 there were 108 overdoses, in 2015 there were 137 overdoses, and in 2016 there were 134 overdoses by the end of November. And in 2017, it is estimated to only get worse, according to Substance Abuse Violence Intervention Program Coordinator Amy Baker. For WRFL FM, I'm Michael Ayers.
Today, we have two guests here to discuss what is being done around the community for addicts to get help. University of Kentucky pharmacy professor and CEO of Anti-Op, Dr. Daniel Wormeling, along with one of Fayette County Health Department workers, John Moses. Thank you both for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Doctor, we'll start with you. You and your company developed a way to deliver an antidote to heroin overdoses by nasal spray. Almost anyone can use the nasal spray naloxone to reverse opioid overdoses, including heroin overdoses. Tell us a little bit about it.
So the active ingredient is called naloxone, and it's been FDA approved since 1971. Its traditional use has been in the hospital for reversal of, not overdoses, but over medication, typically when people have surgery or colonoscopy or something of that nature. The ambulances have also carried it when an overdose is discovered, which could have been from an accident that occurs from people who have legally prescribed opioids. Along some spectrum, which could include abuse and people being dependent on opioids. So the way that naloxone traditionally has been given is with a needle. Okay, so it's an injectable product. And back in the late 90s then, in large cities where overdoses were common from heroin before what we see today, the paramedics learned to use the injection administered intranasally so they wouldn't have to use a needle in the course of reviving someone. And using naloxone induces withdrawal, and people can wake up very angry and agitated and violent. And so that is an occupational hazard for paramedics when needles are around, because 80% of the population they serve would be HIV or hepatitis C positive in large cities. So that was the off-label use of naloxone injection by spraying it into the nose. Now we've had this movement to provide outpatient dispensing and prescriptions of naloxone and to make it more available to the public and to improve the utility of it, then you can make it into a nasal spray. And then you're enabling pre-hospital treatment before the ambulance comes. And that's the main advantage then of this strategy, is that you are providing an opportunity to save time. This is no different than drowning in the sense that your brain doesn't have oxygen. And so the sooner we can get people breathing again on their own, the more likely it is that they're going to survive and that their brain function will be retained.
Sure. And so, as we know, heroin is an illegal street drug. However, people, like you were saying, do overdose on legal drugs that are opiates prescribed by their doctors for severe pain. Just to clarify, does naloxone nasal spray work to reverse those overdoses as well?
So naloxone works as an antidote for opioids, regardless of which one it is, but it does not reverse anything else. So if they happen to take Xanax tablets or sleeping pills, muscle relaxants, drink alcohol, naloxone has no effect on reversing any of those things. And one of the risk factors for having an overdose is that the toxicity of the opioid is multiplied when you take other central nervous system depressants along with them. Okay, so think of the movie stars that you have read about in the news, like Philip Seymour Hoffman, the Glee star, Prince. Many of these are multiple intoxications where there's more than one substance in their body at the same time.
Gotcha. And then, John, this question is based for you. So, based on your knowledge and work with the health department, do all intravenous drug users end up using heroin? And, Doctor, you can answer this as well.
Absolutely not. People are using all kinds of drugs, and at the health department, our needle exchange is simply a public health program that was designed to use a harm reduction model to stop the spread of HIV and hepatitis C. And people who come into our program on Friday afternoons are injecting heroin, but they're also injecting methamphetamines, opioids, silicone and testosterone in our transgender community. They're also using needles. People who are tattooing at home and piercing at home. And so it encompasses more than just heroin.
Gotcha. And we're going to talk a little bit more about your needle exchange program here in a minute. This next question is for the both of you. How dangerous are the additives we're hearing about now that are being used to cut heroin, drugs like fentanyl and animal tranquilizers? And then following with that, is there a way for users to find pure heroin and know what they're getting?
Well, those are very good questions. Of course, we know that heroin is being cut with other substances. And the real answer, I guess, to your questions is no. There is no way of the participant knowing if it's 100% pure heroin, where it's come from, what it's cut with. And so when the drugs come into the United States, different people have their hands in the mix, and it's all about the money. And so they get cut with many different things along the way before it ever reaches somewhere like Kentucky.
The even more dangerous element of it now is that they're not bothering to cut. They're issuing pure synthetic opioids, which is what fentanyl is, and carfentanil. And so the ability to synthesize this is not hard. Our police department has discovered, not ours in Fayette County, but a state police department has discovered a carfentanil synthetic lab in a place in Kentucky. And the movement in this regard is that synthetic opioids, because they're so much more potent and they don't require the costs of growing opium poppies, there's no agricultural element. You don't have labor because you don't have people out there cutting opium poppies and scraping off the black tar that comes off. That's why you get black tar heroin. And so the cartels in Mexico would then receive synthetic opioids from China that are synthesized and come in. And we are now aware of pure fentanyl and carfentanil as a solid substance being distributed here in our community and in and where I was today in Nicholasville. And so that is even so extremely dangerous because the speed of onset and the intensity is just the way I can explain it. Remember in the television shows, they would show somebody being put to sleep for surgery, right? Yeah. And they would have the syringe and they'd give you a couple of medicines and you would be asked to count backwards from 10, right? And you wouldn't get down to 5. That's what's happening. And so the collapse is almost immediate because it's intravenous and these are so powerful that they shut you down almost immediately. And so people collapse almost immediately from those two substances.
Okay. And going on the same subject of naloxone, naloxone has been the antidote for opioid overdoses since the 1960s and 70s, but it had to be injected using a needle. Oftentimes, this took too long, and too many people were uncomfortable or didn't even know how to use a needle syringe. Reporter Michael Ayers has more on the innovation of naloxone as a nasal spray, specifically within the healthcare field.
Every ambulance and emergency room has a naloxone kit in their ambulance. Director at Center for the Advancement of Pharmacy Practice, Dr. Patricia Freeman, has been hands-on with naloxone for many years as well.
This is not a requirement by the Board of Pharmacy to become naloxone certified. So it's completely voluntary, right? So a pharmacist has to say, I want to play this role in public health. And so I want to go the extra mile and get the training and then apply to the board and get my certification so I can do this.
According to Dr. Freeman, she has helped 1,500 pharmacists become naloxone certified in 18 months. For WRFL-FM, I'm Michael Ayers.
The University of Kentucky offers naloxone training for individuals that may know a friend or family member that is an intravenous drug user. In October of 2015, the UK College of Pharmacy announced training session for pharmacists in the state of Kentucky on how to administer the naloxone prescription nasal spray. Now, Doctor, we touched a little bit on this earlier, but I think that it's worth repeating for our audience. It's not just EMTs and pharmacists who can be trained in administering naloxone, correct?
That's correct. The whole point is to enable every citizen to be able to save another person's life. And so at the needle exchange program, for example, we've dispensed hundreds of kits. I've released maybe 1,700 kits myself. And the ability to perform, to know to do CPR, the rescue breathing, call 911. You need expert help. Okay? And you can give naloxone as a head start before the ambulance comes. Because what you're trying to do is restore oxygen to the bloodstream and to the brain. So call 911. Do rescue breathing, give the antidote, continue rescue breathing, and you stay there doing that until one of two things happen. They wake up and start breathing, or the paramedic arrives. Okay? And if you do those things, the chance of survival is high. These are things that anybody can do. And I hearken back to the 1990s when CPR and electronic defibrillators were then placed into all of our public buildings by public policy. And public service announcements were then aired on television and radio explaining what any citizen can do, okay? So that they could perform CPR, use the defibrillator, and they may save someone who had a cardiac arrest. This is no different conceptually. It's just a different medical purpose. And so my hope through a variety of educational mechanisms, including this radio show, that we can educate the public about what it is that they can do. And you can read about these things on websites and all kinds of avenues to learn about it. And as Dr. Freeman was saying, you can go to any pharmacy, and particularly every Kroger pharmacy, and get a kit without having to go to the physician So the pharmacist can initiate the prescription. You can go see your doctor. Or, like for the needle exchange program, so I'm there every Friday afternoon, and you can come and receive a prescription from me. So the goal then is to increase public awareness and to provide greater access to the antidote to more people who are around individuals who are at higher risk of having an overdose. And so if there are siblings, cousins, mothers, fathers who are hearing this, these are things that you can learn how to do on your own. And if you go to the pharmacy to get a kit, they'll counsel you on all of these things, on how to do it. Okay? It's available.
Okay, and just to make it sure, crystal clear for our audience, you were touching on it in the end of that. How much training is needed to be able to safely administer naloxone?
Almost nothing. We do the training. So pharmacists have 6 required elements to train people on. That's the law. And so we go through those in either walk-in clinics, like the needle exchange program, or I go to rehab centers, halfway houses, shelters. People schedule large events or meetings where they get a cafeteria together and say, we'll bring 30 people, will you come? And I say, sure, I'll come, and we'll do the training, and we fill out the prescription paperwork, and away they walk with a prescription. So like at the Hope Center, we did almost 50 in an hour and 10 minutes. When I bring the pharmacy students with me, they are technicians registered with the state, and so they can help me with the prescription paperwork. And so time is not really the big barrier for this. It's a willingness to engage yourself and take the responsibility for it. And that's sometimes a challenge for people to say, holy cow, this is something that's so important that it's life-saving. And then when you approach that in a typical medical sense, folks sort of get the willies about it, right? And say, wow, I don't know if I can take that responsibility. But that's what's necessary. And what I worry about or hear is if you can go on YouTube and see mothers who over the years wished they knew about naloxone after their child died, right? And so they didn't know what to do when they found them on the front porch or in the bathroom or in their bed. Okay, they didn't know what to do. And so they're in tears on an interview like this being televised or taped. Audio, video. And so it's quite heart-wrenching to watch that because they didn't know. And so for, you know, if you're a student here on campus and your mom's worried about one of your siblings, go talk to your mom, right? So that you can have a plan about what can happen in that family. That's what it comes down to in the end, is that you can't keep the knowledge about this to yourself. The family has to have a conversation. We have to know what an overdose looks like, what'll happen. You got to know where the Narcan is, where the naloxone is, and how to use it. Okay? Everybody has to know that for this to work. If you keep it a secret, this will fail. You can't keep any secrets.
Okay, and let's talk about that secret. So how exactly would one administer the Narcan or the naloxone?
So if you've used Afrin nasal spray before or any nasal steroid spray, it's a nose cone that fits into the nostril. It has to go all the way up, if you will, to where the skin and the bone meet on the inside. So the tip is there, you activate it, and it sprays the mist inside your cheek. And so when you've had Afrin or Flonase nasal spray, things like this for allergies, that's where the medicine actually goes. Is inside your cheek. When you breathe, it goes through your nose, around your cheek, down your throat. That's the airflow. So we want the drug to sit there and then it can be absorbed, just like people would snort cocaine. That's where the drug goes, is inside your cheek, and there's a nice blood supply there and gets absorbed. No different.
Gotcha. And so, gentlemen, we've been talking a little bit about it tonight, and that's the needle exchange program. So let's go ahead and address it. The needle exchange is a free health service for intravenous drug users. A Kentucky Senate bill approved the program. The needle exchange is supposed to prevent diseases like hepatitis C and HIV from spreading. At the needle exchange, you can also receive a naloxone spray kit. Mothers, fathers, and students will come into the needle exchange and bring in their dirty needles replaced with new ones. As of January 20th of 2016, the Needle Exchange has had 860 individual visits, making a total of 2,873. Over 61,000 needles have been collected, and in return, over 76,000 needles have been given to users, with 38 people being referred to rehab. At each needle exchange, there is a professional to assist those seeking to get treatment in the form of rehab. While the needle exchange program has helped addicts receive clean needles, HIV, and hepatitis C testing, others may say the problem lies elsewhere. Michael Ayers reports.
Graduate student at the University of Kentucky working on his master's in couple and family therapy. Alex was addicted to heroin and is currently in recovery. Alex says the real problem occurs when people are released from treatment.
And the idea is that addiction is a chronic brain disease. And so like any other chronic disease, it has to be treated on an ongoing basis. Unfortunately, we make such an emphasis on getting people into treatment. So they go, let's say 30 days of treatment, when they walk out on day 31, they have an untreated disease. So they're walking around town with an untreated disease, and then we're astonished that relapse rates are near 90%. But it's not astonishing to me, because with any other disease when left untreated, relapse rates would be similar.
For WRFL-FM, I'm Michael Ayers.
All right, John, if you will, go ahead and step us through the process of referring someone to rehab.
Sure. Well, we have anywhere from 120 to 150 clients that come through the needle exchange every Friday. And during that exchange, they, of course, bring in the used needles that they've used for the week, get their clean needles for the next week. We are offering each participant an HIV test and Hep C test, as you had mentioned. And we talk to them about treatment options. But the needle exchange was not set up as a treatment program. That is not our end goal. Our end goal is from a public health side, which is to just stop the spread of communicable disease. And so when we first started to set up the program, we interviewed people who were injecting drugs, people who were in jail on drug charges. And what we learned from them is that if we try to force them into anything, they're not going to come. And so the way that the law is and what we're trying to accomplish, if all they want to do is come in and exchange their needles for the week, that's all they have to do. But we are going to offer them drug and alcohol counseling. And so we have Amy Baker, who you mentioned earlier, that's there every Friday, and all they have to do is say the word, "I'd like to talk to somebody. I don't know my options." It may be that someone wants medical detox or wants to do Suboxone or just needs a recovery place to go cold turkey. And so Amy has resources in several counties in this area to where we can refer people, and we can do it that day.
Gotcha. And so right now, if we had a listener who wanted to enter one of those programs and go to rehab, is there a waiting list or is it pretty quick to get in?
It's pretty quick to get in. With us operating on Fridays, sometimes it may be I'm not going to get you in until Monday, but just a couple of days. We're not talking about a long waiting list. She's real good at finding beds.
Good. And now, with free needles and the life-saving naloxone kits and even 911 at people's fingertips, some may argue that the intravenous drug users are getting too much help and the free needles encourage drug use. How would you respond to them?
Well, that's completely the opposite, actually. No one woke up this morning and said, "Hey, the health department's giving out free needles. I'm going to start using heroin." It just doesn't work that way. The same way that no one starts to have sex because we hand out free condoms at the health department. And so I don't look at it as if we're enabling them to do anything. The great news is that we're stopping the spread of communicable disease, but they're they're also touching a healthcare provider, sometimes for the first time in a really long time. And so we get them in the door. We offer them a variety of services, again, not pushing anything on them. But we have our health department public health clinic that can provide many different services, as well as the screenings that we do and pick up naloxone if you need it. So a variety of things is what we're doing on Fridays.
And two, you were talking earlier about how your mission is to stop the diseases from being spread. And around 10% of those in Kentucky with HIV got it from sharing a needle. Fayette County alone had over 1,000 cases of HIV last year, and there are currently 947 people living with HIV. First, and this is for the both of you, are we surprised by these statistics?
I'm not surprised at all. The HIV rates have been steady over the last 30 years. We see about one new infection here in Kentucky every day that's reported. We also know that anywhere from 25 to 30% of people living with HIV in Kentucky don't even know they have it, because here in Kentucky, we don't do a very good job of getting people tested early. And a lot of times people find out that they not only have HIV, but have progressed to AIDS. Because they end up in the hospital or in the ER.
Gotcha. Doctor, do you have anything to add?
What we see now that is the most troubling is the increase in hepatitis C indices. And so I remember when the heroin issue several years ago first hit, it was in northern Kentucky, where this drug comes down on ice. So I-75 is a big portal for where things go. And so Covington and Northern, so Kenton, Boone, and Campbell County had a 200% increase in their hepatitis C indices as a result of the change from having less access to prescription pills. And since we haven't changed their brains, they're going to seek access to a less expensive and accessible alternative.
Okay, and then going off of that too with a second question, do you think that without the needle exchange that these numbers would be higher?
I absolutely do think that. Part of what helped to push the bill through originally that allowed us to do needle exchange was due to the HIV outbreak in Austin, Indiana, a couple of years ago, where we had over 200 people test positive for HIV in a small town of about 4,000. There was a lot of injecting drug use, prostitution. They were on a highway, a lot of truckers going up and down the highway as well, and a lot of drug use. And we found whole families that had been infected with HIV, and about 90% of those were also co-infected with hepatitis C. And the CDC released last year a map of areas that are vulnerable for that kind of outbreak. And something like 57 of the counties that are at highest risk for an outbreak were in Kentucky, particularly in eastern Kentucky.
Gotcha. And unfortunately, gentlemen, we are running out of time. So if you had to quickly leave one thing for our listeners about this topic, what would it be?
For me, it's that people who inject drugs are humans. They're not who you may think they are. And when they come into the health department, they're treated with respect and dignity as every human being should be. Our program is an anonymous program that will get them in the door. And we're seeing great strides in changing people's lives.
Gotcha. And doctor?
For your families, for your membership in a family, or you have friends and you know that there's a circumstance or a problem, these are things that you need to do to help that person who has this medical problem, and you can help protect their life. So education doesn't kill people. And then having access to naloxone could be an excellent pre-hospital thing that you can do to help save someone's life, save time.
Well, I want to thank you both for being here today and coming out to speak with us. And again, our guests were the CEO of Anti-Op Incorporated and University of Kentucky Pharmacy Professor Dr. Daniel Wormeling, along with the Disease Intervention Outreach Specialist John Moses. Lastly, you can go to kentucky.gov/stopoverdoseskentucky to locate the nearest naloxone certified pharmacist. For more information, visit the Lexington Health Department website. For Campus Voices on WRFL 88.1, this is Penny Schmitz. Thank you for joining us.
Hey there. If you're enjoying this podcast from WRFL Lexington, you may enjoy our live radio stream at WRFL.fm and, of course, via radio at 88.1 FM in the Central Kentucky area. We have a wide variety of programs you're sure to enjoy. Just go to WRFL.fm/schedule and see what programs appeal most to you. Thanks again for listening to this podcast from WRFL Lexington.